Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. In a world loosed from its moorings, Behind the News still offers the reassuring feel of terra firma. Two guests, two segments. Lily Lynch will talk about last week's NATO summit, and Megan Greenwell will catalog the ravages of private equity. NATO held its annual summit on June 24th and 25th in The Hague. It was an extremely expensive, locked-down, and disorganized affair, as we'll hear. The star of the show was, as is too often the case, Donald Trump, whose threats to leave the alliance have caused jitters in Europe. The Europeans often strike an independent pose, but at least for now, always end up kneeling before their American masters. Or Daddy, as NATO Supremo Mark Rutte called him. No joke. Trump had demanded that Europe raise its military budget. He seems unable to comprehend that the designers of the U.S. empire invented a masterful structure for world domination, of which NATO has been a crucial part. He sees the security arrangement, under which the U.S. provides a defense guarantee in return for vassal-like fealty, as nothing but exploitative. To Trump, they've been free riders and it's time for them to pay up. So he's insisted they boost military spending to 5% of GDP. All participants but Spain agreed, though it's unlikely that all will follow through. Curiously, U.S. military spending is well short of 5%. 3.7% at latest count. We haven't been at 5% in 13 years. Getting to 5% would require a boost of $400 billion, or 40%, in the Pentagon's budget. You have to wonder if Trump knows that, but let's not tell him. For more on the summit, we're joined by Lily Lynch, who wrote it up on her Substack. After many years of living in and writing about the Balkans, Lily has recently moved to Istanbul. You'll hear some seabirds in the background at the beginning of the interview. I hope they're not too distracting, but I thought it was a nice touch to bring the sounds of the Bosporus to Behind the News. Lily Lynch. That NATO summit, which concluded, what, a week ago or so, sounded extremely expensive and extremely chaotic. You expect more efficiency out of the Dutch. What was going on?
That's a really good point. My feeling is exact same. It reportedly was the most expensive meeting in history, not just the most expensive NATO summit, but the most expensive meeting in history, 1.2 million euros per minute.
How can you spend that much money on a conference?
Presumably, it was on mostly on security, because it certainly was not on organization or food. No shade to the Dutch culinary experience.
Not one of the world's great cuisines. So.
Definitely not. Lots of fried cheese and hot dogs. But the city was very much heavily shut down. It was eerie, because, you know, The Hague is already quieter than a lot of other cities because there are so few cars. People are on bikes. But if you combine that with the fact that, like, streets were closed down for the summit, it was just, like, quiet. It was eerie, kind of a post-apocalyptic feeling. Just a ton of security, lots of helicopters flying overhead. There are people all over the city, like, looking like they were in Iraq. Soldiers who were, like, fully kitted up for war.
God.
Not just like gendarmerie or security, like I've seen in some other places for riots, but like actual like war, people outfitted for like full-scale war. Certainly they paid for a lot of people. They paid for a very useless app to be designed specifically for this stupid summit, and the app turned out to be like effectively useless. And
as you point out, it might have been a backdoor for Palantir.
Yeah, I was like, I probably shouldn't download this. I should probably think twice about it. But I also was like, maybe it will give me the information I need to like navigate this extremely Byzantine, mysterious, and confusing event.
Everything is about Trump. Mark Rutte, is that how you pronounce his name, kicked off the proceedings by invoking the magic name of Trump. And, you know, the whole thing from then on was all about our big guy.
Yes, very much so. Secretary General Mark Rutte, previously the Dutch Prime Minister, who's been Secretary General of NATO, I think, for about a year. You could tell he was really putting on quite a show. Like, it was almost nauseating a bit, the sort of servility that was being performed.
He called Trump Daddy, right?
Yeah, that was like the big takeaway. I think that like they wanted the big takeaway from the event to be that like all the NATO member states were going to be paying 5% of their GDP for defense spending, which was a big talking point. But I think what everybody really will remember is the daddy comment, which came on the last day.
Was he serious? Was he making a joke?
Making a very stupid joke. So basically, like, remember Trump had made that joke right before getting on Air Force One in Washington, D.C. when he was leaving for Hit the Hague. He said something like about Israel and Iran, like, they don't know what the they're doing. The clip went very viral, of course. And Mark Rutte, Secretary General of NATO, in a press conference with Trump on the last day of the summit, said something like, sometimes daddy has to use strong language.
Oh, my God. Well, I mean, it fits all these right-wing things about daddy's home. Like, Trump is going to, like, whip us all into shape. And it was just really bizarre to hear that infiltrate diplomatic language. It's just surreal.
Totally surreal. Of course, Trump loved it. And actually, I think the most sort of relaxed moment of the Trump press conference, which was on the last day, the big Trump press conference, where he was flanked on either side by Hegseth and Rubio, was when a Sky News journalist in this like really posh British accent asked him about being called daddy by Rutte. And Trump was like, he really likes me. And actually, Hegseth and Rubio have been, like, totally stone-faced, like, no expression, like, stern. The entire time, they both burst out laughing about the daddy comments.
Wow. So, as a reporter, did you feel like there was much you could do, or were you just a spectator? I used to go to these World Bank IMF annual meetings, sit in the press room, but unless you were the FT or the Wall Street Journal, you couldn't really talk to anybody of importance. All that was going on was behind closed doors, so was it a similar feel to you?
Yeah, kind of. What was so frustrating about this, and I talked to a couple other people who've been to other summits in recent years, so they had reference for comparison, is just that the rules kept changing. So, like, arbitrarily and without announcement. So, like, one day or 1 hour, you would, like, need to be approved by a government delegation to get into a press conference and have, like, an opportunity to talk to somebody important. And then the next minute they would abolish that. Everything was open to the media. It was like, they were just in one, you know, one day you needed a gold badge. The next day you needed like a blue badge. It was like really stupid. And like, there were no announcements. There was no schedule. There was no like clear schedule that stated the German chancellor is going to be speaking at 4 o'clock in this particular building. Nothing. You just had to, everything was like you were thrown in. And so it took me 2 days to sort of like figure out. I mean, I did get to be in the front row for Mark Rutte, but then I ran into Michael Tracy actually. And I was like, okay, another like a weirdo is here, as I wrote in my article, like my little piece.
Yes.
Like, another person who's probably a little bit critical of this whole like theater, this like Hulk circus. And you know, Michael's great at like getting what he wants and then like being assertive, and like, so at that point then everything was just like, it was like we were on a roll. I ended up then speaking to the, or like listening to, I didn't ask any questions because Trump's press conference kind of was about to start, so I bolted. But I first got in with the Croatian prime minister, who doesn't sound that interesting for probably most people, but for me, it's a fascinating and kind of hilarious figure. You know, it was a very Balkan male, like macho. It was like, I wasn't sucking up to Trump, basically, like, trying to like apologize for it. Then went in to see Trump, but nobody knew what was happening. The most informed CNN anchor, New York Times, everyone, till the last minute, nobody knew who was actually going to be speaking in this big hall. We kind of all were just like following each other. Like, if you, I was like, okay, that person's from the anchor for CBS, so she must be going somewhere important. But we didn't know whether we were just going to see like Mark Rutte again, which we did, like, and he gave his final like press conference of the week. And then so we were like, okay, so maybe Trump's not coming. Maybe that was just, you know, because he had a press conference that morning with Rutte, so maybe we were all just like getting the wrong information. And I got an email from Erdogan's like press person, and they were like, Mr. Erdogan's going to be speaking at 4 o'clock for the entire media, you know, all media is invited. And so I was like, how is it possible that maybe Trump's really not going to come in, because we only have like 45 minutes until 4 o'clock. Suddenly this like really angry sounding American woman starts yelling, and she's like, clear out the first two rows immediately. If you do not, you will be removed from the hall. And she was like, just like really angry. And I was like, okay, it's Trump. Like, Trump's coming. Like, nobody else talked like that the entire time, you know?
Daddy's emissary.
Yeah, exactly. Daddy's emissary. And then, like, the peroxide blondes walked in, like, and all took up the first row. It was kind of funny to be in the room when Trump's doing his whole, like, combative thing with the press, you know? And he's, like, doing the fake news CNN, and, like, he loves the, you know, he loves the energy of antagonism, you know, that towards the press. Like, the usual Trump thing, like, as you see on TV, you know, which would more...
If he weren't so awful, he'd be entertaining.
He is entertaining. I mean, I have no problem saying that. He actually is an entertainer, a professional entertainer and showman. So, and that really comes across in, you know, with his facial expressions in person and everything. The whole thing was kind of obscene, you know, just because you could tell that, like, he had just had this, like, intense day of meetings with NATO leaders. And he was like, you know, he's talking like he just learned what NATO is supposed to be. He's like, you know, NATO just would not be the same without the United States. It's like, that's what everybody has been trying to, like, impart to him, right? Like, the president of the United States is saying that. It was hilarious. It was funny, you know, to me. It's like, I don't...
Well, this is a guy who didn't know the Declaration of Independence. He thought it was about the Civil War. What are you going to do? Okay, so the news that came into this event, I guess two big pieces of news. One, the commitment to spend 5% of GDP on the military, which is not what the U.S. does. I think last I looked, we were under 4%. They committed to that, with the exception of Spain. Orban said it's not going to happen. Do you think he's right?
I think he's totally right. Orban's obviously, like, a hugely critical of all this stuff, but, like, even officials from, like, far more uber-Atlanticist, dedicated countries and ministries said, like, you know, well, it's really unfortunate that Spain couldn't just publicly say, yeah, sure, we'll pay 5%, because they're not going to really be expected to do that. You know, that's essentially what I was told. I mean, that's what they said. And I mean, what they were saying was, yes, we're all going to be paying more. And I think that's very true. I mean, it's clear that the Europeans have kind of been shocked into action in some way. And that,
well, if you look at European defense stocks, they believe it.
Okay, so that's there you go. I mean, there is clearly a very dramatic change in behavior. But whether that rises to all countries in NATO besides Spain spending 5%, I think that's total, like, theater, and it's just messaging for Trump and Russia, really.
It does seem very easy to manipulate Trump. You could just lie to him, flatter him, and he won't look too critically if it's what he wants to hear.
Apparently. That seems to be what happened over the course of, like, you know, a 24-hour period. You know, he was greeted by the Dutch king and spent the night at the Dutch king's palace and met the queen and, you know, had this very fancy dinner. Like, that's what happens at every summit, I guess, with the all the other leaders of NATO. And but yeah, I mean, apparently, you know, he was it was just funny to see, you know, the kind of the Trumpian interpretation of, like, what NATO was and, like, why, you know, he's so important for keeping it going. And it was very clear that, yeah, it was pretty easy to manipulate him. And I would say, like, you know, as horrible as, like, Rutte sounded to me and, like, other Americans I spoke with, you know, the Europeans who are really feel like it's an existential danger for the U.S. to, like, reduce its footprint in Europe, they felt that this was, like, a necessary evil, which is, like, pathetic behavior. I mean, the people I spoke with who were like, hey, you know, it worked. You suddenly see Trump, who's, like, taking NATO more seriously. It was a very sort of warm and positive feeling that was kind of left with people, even though, of course, he's antagonistic towards the media, but that wasn't particularly anything new. Trump can change his mind in 2 days. He'd be like, my pal Vladimir in Moscow, you know, like, in a couple of days. You have no idea. They think it's just, like, a one-off thing where they can, like, call him daddy and, like, then everything's fine. You know, it's not going to work like that. They're going to have to be, like, constantly trying to find new ways to flatter him, basically.
I'm speaking with the journalist Lily Lynch. For a long time, we've been hearing about the EU establishing some degree of independence as a military, financial, political power. And every time it looks like they're really just not up to it. They always fall back on this relation with the United States.
It's so fascinating. It really is. Yeah. I mean, I thought really that they were getting to some big fork in the road. You even heard a few weeks ago Chancellor Merz from Germany saying we have to, like, reconsider our relationship with the United States. And, like, there was really some sort of rhetoric that seemed pretty serious. But yeah, but then I think that there is this recognition that both for their own defense and for Ukraine, they can't just overnight suddenly demonstrate any kind of like meaningful autonomy. And I think that, you know, that's probably like practical reality. I still think there's a sort of willingness to fall back on daddy and look to daddy for direction and for foreign policy opinions. Another way that it kind of was less obvious maybe, but Bruce came out the first day, here's what I'm trying to say, and immediately just pledged, you know, like total support for U.S. attacks on Iran. This is a great thing. No other country in the world could do this. We're so grateful for the United States for like finally getting rid of those nuclear weapons facilities. And like, no, it's not a violation of international law. Like, it's all by the book. No suggestion of that is acceptable. Within the alliance, there are some small pockets of dissent. We can point to, say, Spain, even the Croatian leader who was calling American policy in Israel with Israel a disaster. Obviously, Erdogan is very vocal about Gaza. There are these points of some dissent, but I do think that in general, the allies look to daddy still.
You said in the piece, every time Trump said he had brokered peace between Serbia and Kosovo, we laughed so hard that the Secret Service guy on our side of the room glared at us. We don't pay that much attention to that part of the world. So, first of all, what's going on between these two countries? And what about Trump's claim that he brokered peace?
It's so funny because I was kind of saying for the first couple of months of this Trump administration, you know, this winter and early spring, I was like, I actually support the Trump administration's Balkan policy, which is like pretending that the region doesn't exist, because generally sometimes when the West sort of decides that the Balkans exist, there's a lot of tampering with the internal politics, and recently that has meant really supporting Aleksandar Vučić, the president of Serbia, who Mark Rutte said again in his first press conference was his very close friend and who he talks with regularly, is in permanent dialogue with.
And that was some guarantee of peace, right, or something?
Basically, it's another Trump-type thing, where it's like, here's the kind of a terrible guy who, like, it's better to have him on our side than have him, like, unleashing violence across the entire region. Which, so it has, like, I guess, some kind of pragmatic rationale. I don't want to pretend like it doesn't have some of that. I have heard it articulated many times, and I do understand it to a certain extent. I just think that is wearing quite thin at this point. Getting back to Trump, so I was saying in the first few months of this administration, I was like, okay, ignoring the Balkans is like, you know, that's not a bad policy. And then suddenly Trump is now talking about Kosovo and Serbia all the time. During his first administration, he brought together the leaders of Kosovo and Serbia into like the Oval Office, and like it was like basically a total humiliating situation. Where the best part was a great clip about it that was very viral, where President Vučić of Serbia didn't read the document that he signed before he signed it, and so on camera, Trump says, "It's great, Vučić, that you've agreed to move your embassy to Jerusalem." It was like all part of this quote unquote peace deal with Kosovo, but also, of course, because Israel must always be shoehorned into everything, Israel ended up getting embassies moved to Jerusalem, which is what it wanted. There's a great clip where Vučić, like, he's like, looks like, goes pale because he looks in shock and he like breathes through the note in like terror, like, "Oh my God, I can't believe I just signed it." His head in his hands. So this is called the Washington Agreement. This is supposedly going to bring peace to Serbia and Kosovo. It was one of these things that as soon as Trump left office, everyone was like, did that even happen? Nothing came of it. In the years since, there have been, you know, periodic spasms of violence and people have been killed. Nothing like a full-scale war, but just like on the border and in the northern part of Kosovo or the Serb majority area, there have been some, you know, shootouts and so forth. So the idea that like Trump brought peace to Kosovo and Serbia is just hilarious because it's just like completely false. Like there's just like nothing about it that's true at all. The situation in Kosovo is the exact same as it was before this agreement. It's neither worse nor better. It's just like the exact same. It had no effect. He's been talking about the Congo and like Rwanda and, you know, you've probably seen this recently as well. Like, of course, India, Pakistan. I think he's emphasizing these supposed wins because he realizes he hasn't managed to get any real results on Ukraine. He hasn't managed to get a ceasefire in Gaza, if he ever even wanted one. So
the easiest buy time for Israel to do its destructive work.
Exactly. Yeah.
24 hours he was going to solve the war in Ukraine, and we're well past that 24 hours.
Yes.
Now, what about this Serbian guy? What kind of trouble is he potentially causing?
Oh, Vučić, the president.
Yeah.
I've just spent so much of my life thinking about this one man. His party has been in power since 2012. You know, he's amassed, like, near total control of the country. It's basically a mafia state now. There's no question. The whole country is basically held hostage by this one person. There have been protests ongoing since November in response to the collapse of a canopy at a train station in Novi Sad, the second biggest city in Serbia. The government was not particularly forthcoming about the situation surrounding that accident. And this is really just the latest scandal in years and years of cover-ups and scandals and lies, attacks that are never fully explained on the total degradation of the media space, totally transformed into like pro-Vučić kind of tabloid ocean of just sort of sameness. I mean, there are a couple of exceptions to that. He has really managed to stay in power by playing East and West off each other, which I actually don't have a particular problem with his foreign policy. I think I had a problem with how he conducts it. But in theory, I think that, you know, some degree of like independence and neutrality in foreign policy is like, you know, admirable potentially. But he's really detested that he is like elections have been manipulated, and there have been allegations of that. These huge protests and, like, you know, police attacking students and, you know, members of the ruling party attacking students, cars plowing into crowds and so forth and so on. As for regional unrest, I'm not convinced that that is imminent or even possible, really, in the current conditions, because I don't know. First of all, Serbia is completely integrated into... It's not a member of NATO, but it's coordinates with NATO in Kosovo, where there are still NATO-led peacekeeping troops called KFOR. Actually, as I was sitting next to the Serb from Kosovo at the NATO summit, he was, you know, saying, you know, we support the continued presence of these peacekeepers because we feel like they're guaranteeing our security in Kosovo as a minority. So, first of all, there are peacekeeping troops there. Of course, we can say that in the 90s, though, they were effectively peacekeeping troops in Bosnia, and they were effectively useless. All the worst atrocities were committed under the watchful eye of the United Nations. But still, I think that it's a very different world now than in the 1990s. Vučić could not start. There would just be no possibility for a full-scale regional war, because what allowed that to happen in the 1990s, in large part, was the fact that Milosevic, you know, could export violence from Belgrade when the Yugoslav People's Army was spread out across the entire territory of the former Yugoslavia and was the fourth biggest army in Europe. Vučić does not have that capacity. He doesn't have an army like that that's like stationed in Bosnia or in Kosovo. Of course, yes, there will be spasms of violence. There's going to be clashes. There will be people killed and injured periodically, as there have been since the war's ended. I do not see the prospect for a full-scale war. In addition, I would say, in conclusion, it's my last point for that, there's so many young people are gone. What are you fighting for now? In the 1990s, people were fighting to have a country, like to have a nation where they're either fighting for or for nationalism. Now, it's just people want to go to Germany and they want to get a good job.
I believe that was our last conversation. We talked about how the Balkans are emptying out.
Exactly. That kind of comes back to that.
Finally, you say when Trump left, all the reporters left too. There are only like a dozen reporters left to cover Erdogan's statements. Turkey's a rather important player in NATO and also the Middle East. It seems kind of weird not to pay attention to what he had to say, but what did he have to say?
It was ridiculous. You know, I get that Trump is like a hard act to follow, and of course the show around Trump, you know, is like what everybody was kind of waiting for. In a way, you know, as somebody who just moved to Turkey and just started to write about Turkey, it was actually kind of cool to have this like really intimate press conference. I was sitting in the front row center, and like he was like, Erdogan was looking me directly in the eye, like, you know, at various points. And like, the entire like Turkish delegation, including the foreign minister, were like sitting right next to me, basically like, a couple feet away from me.
Does he have any personal charm or charisma or anything like that?
I can see how he would for a certain kind of person. He has a sort of like stern, grandfatherly vibe. I can see why a certain kind of person would sort of like that sort of stern, grandfatherly kind of figure looking over everybody, keeping everybody in line. And I lived under Vučić, who was like he's like a charisma vacuum in Serbia. Like, so it just is, so maybe Erdogan is just interesting to me. In the context of NATO, the Turks have actually played a relatively, like, decent role in the war in Ukraine. They've been hosting, like, negotiations, peace talks. So the only country in NATO or since 2022. And this is not to brush the Erdogan's many crimes and faults under the rug, but I'm saying in the context of NATO, Turkey is actually relatively, to me, kind of sympathetic. I mean, they've hosted peace talks. They brokered the Black Sea grain deal. I mean, there was the Istanbul communique, like, you know, would have brought the war in Ukraine to a close in like March 2022. I was here earlier this spring. There were two rounds of peace talks, and of course, those didn't produce what we would like to see, but there weren't entirely nothing. I mean, there was a prisoner exchange, the biggest prisoner exchange of the war. So actually, and after hearing, you know, like Mark Rutte call Trump daddy and like, you know, and pledge, you know, total undying support to Israel, at least it was like a little, it was refreshing to hear somebody mention Gaza and genocide. And even if it's strictly rhetoric, it was actually like an interesting way. I got to see both my presidents. I got to see Trump, and then I got to see like the president of my adopted country now.
That was Lily Lynch. Her article, NATO Goes Dutch, is on her Substack, lilylynch.substack.com. That's lilylynch.substack.com. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. A sort of transatlantic telephone conversation by the 1990s New Zealand band The Mad Scene. Next, private equity. Megan Greenwell is just out with Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream from Day Street Books. It's a look at how that racket works through the stories of four people: a worker for Toys R Us, one of the most notorious casualties of private equity, a newspaper reporter, an industry that's been ravaged by these guys, a tenant at a private equity-owned apartment complex, and a rural doctor whose hospital was wrecked by predatory financiers. Private equity, which generally creates little but instead looks to extract as much value as possible from existing enterprises, often leaving them for dead, is a perfect symbol and agent of what Christian Parenti once called the necrotic phase of American capitalism. Megan Greenwell was most recently an editor at Wired. Before that, she worked at New York Magazine and covered the war in Iraq for the Washington Post. Megan Greenwell. I'll get to the individual stories in a moment, but first, I'm guessing, well, a lot of listeners know what private equity is. Maybe they're not quite sure of the details. Maybe there are a lot of people who don't actually know. So I could just start out with some definitions and some idea of the scope of the thing.
Private equity does a bunch of different things, but when people talk about private equity deals, and when I talk about private equity deals, usually what we're talking about is what's called leveraged buyouts. And a leveraged buyout is essentially when a private equity firm pools together money from outside investors. So university endowments, public pension funds, ultra wealthy individuals, and then combines that money with bank loans to take over a company. So unlike venture capital, this is not investing in a company most of the time. It's buying it entirely. And then the trick is that those loans, which usually make up somewhere between 70 and 80% of any given deal.
The firms themselves don't contribute very much money. It's all outside money, right?
Exactly. It's all outside money. And then those loans, the firm is not responsible for paying them back. Only the company they're acquiring is. So I can buy your company, use exclusively borrowed money to do it, and then say, well, if your company gets in trouble, that's your problem and not mine. I don't have to pay these loans back.
It's really very convenient for them.
Yes, it works out very nicely for the firms.
And they're also adept at shifting other costs, like you write in several cases about the sale-leaseback as a figure into their playbook.
Sale-leasebacks are a huge part of any private equity deal these days. For companies that own a lot of real estate, whether that's one big glamorous headquarters or a lot of chain stores or doctor's offices around the country, the private equity firm will sell off the real estate that the company has previously owned and then charge the company rent for those same properties. So they're not actually moving. They're just now responsible for new rent payments that they didn't have before. In the case of Toys R Us, Toys R Us was a historically fiscally conservative company, and they had for decades owned almost all their own real estate. Now all of a sudden they're in the same stores, but they're paying rent on them. So they have the burden from the loans, and they have these new rent payments. And all of a sudden, Toys R Us was just absolutely buried under debt. And you end up with this weird split in incentives where a sale-leaseback agreement is very good for the private equity firm. It's not good for the portfolio company. So all of a sudden, even though the private equity firm is ostensibly trying to improve the business that they own, they actually don't have much incentive to do so because they can make their money either way.
And often the real estate is precisely what attracts the private equity interest. They don't really care so much about these companies as operating enterprises if they can sell off their real estate.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the real estate is such a huge draw for a lot of private equity firms. Often you'll see a private equity firm and a real estate investment firm partner on a deal. I didn't end up writing about it in the book, but I got really interested in the case of Hahnemann Hospital in downtown Philadelphia, which was an urban safety net hospital, really taking everybody.
It closed during the pandemic, right?
Exactly. It was closed by its private equity owners. There were huge protests. And essentially what they wanted to do was flip it and turn it into luxury condos because they loved the location.
You mentioned venture capitalists, and they may not be my ideal personalities in the world, but they do actually build things, develop new companies, promote new ideas. It seems like most of these private equity guys are just picking value out of what they see as a future corpse.
Yeah, I think that's right. Venture capital, the only way to make money is for the company you're investing in to make money. That's why they're quote-unquote unicorn hunters. Private equity doesn't even need the company to survive to make money. In the case of Toys R Us, which was, one of the most legendary private equity disasters ever, the two private equity firms that co-owned the company made money on that deal while 33,000 employees got laid off without the severance that they were promised in their contract.
Okay, so now let's talk about each of these individuals. You organize the book around four characters who are involved in four different sectors that are very prime targets for private equity. Roger the doctor, healthcare; Natalia the reporter, newspaper sector; Lauren, tenant at a private equity-owned apartment complex; and Liz, the retail worker. Since you talked some about Toys R Us, let's start with Liz's story. How did she end up at Toys R Us, and how did she end up when Toys R Us disappeared?
Yeah, Liz is just an incredibly inspiring person to me. She's an indigenous Alaskan from the Tlingit tribe and only left Alaska because her husband, who she met working in retail, he wanted to go to pharmacy school to improve conditions for their family. And there was no pharmacy school in the entire state of Alaska. So they had to move to the mainland. She had dropped out of high school just before graduation to help care for her sister's baby, and she had worked retail her entire adult life. When they knew they needed to move, she went looking for what is going to be the most stable company. They had three kids, and she was very much a researcher and was thinking, I need a company that will pay pretty well, even for entry-level retail salaries. I need a company that allows freedom of transfer because my husband will have to do his internship somewhere different from where he's in school. I need somewhere where scheduling is predictable because I'm going to have to do a lot of the childcare. We all know that those are hard ingredients to find in retail. And she identified Toys R Us as this is the best possible company for my family and for my career. And she really, you know, set her mind to it and got a job there and was very elaborately researched which store in the Portland, Oregon area she wanted to work at when they moved down there. When she got laid off, along with all 33,000 Toys R Us employees, she was just sort of baffled because she didn't know that her company was owned by private equity at all. Why would she? Her paychecks said Toys R Us on them. Her bosses, seven or eight layers above her, were all Toys R Us employees. So she was not knowledgeable about private equity, and her reaction was just sort of like, how is this legal?
One often has asked that question. You
know? Yes, exactly. And she really went to bat with a bunch of her colleagues for, no, we're going to show people that this is wrong. And she's a huge reason that the Toys R Us story ended up getting as much publicity as it did, because most private equity catastrophe stories do not get that level of attention.
They didn't get a severance payment, but they did manage to shake some money out of the private equity guys.
Yes, they wouldn't call it severance. They called it a hardship fund. But yes, they got $75 million out of the private equity firms. And they brought a lot of attention to how these deals work. One of the really interesting things they did was they went and stood in front of public pension boards and delivered these rousing speeches about how their lives had been affected and said, essentially, don't invest in private equity firms that treat workers badly. And that really helped put the pressure on the two firms in charge.
Yeah, you bring up an important point here. A lot of the funding for private equity comes from pension funds, which are funds held in the name of workers for their benefit in retirement. But they end up really dislocating the lives of many workers along the way.
Yes, I was very fascinated by this. I had a long and very thoughtful conversation with Pete Stavros, who's the co-head of private equity at KKR, one of the big firms, and one of the two that was in charge of Toys R Us. This was right after KKR had bought Simon & Schuster, the publisher. And I said, okay, so why not simply raise publishing workers' salaries? Because it's a famously underpaid industry. And he was almost a little horrified. He said, well, I can't do that because it's not my money. It's the public pension fund's money. It belongs to the teachers and doctors and firefighters and nurses, you know, all of those people who have served the state and expect to get a pension in return. And I had to really sit with that for a minute, because what that philosophy is doing, and it's hardly unique to him, is turning capitalism into a zero-sum game, where in order for some rank-and-file workers to be able to retire comfortably, this other group of workers definitionally has to lose out. And that was really unsettling to me, because it really is the foundation of so much of how private equity operates.
30 years ago, I interviewed the chief counsel of CalPERS, the California Public Employees Retirement System, and I said, how do you feel about using workers' funds to make the lives of workers rather miserable? And he said, our only obligation is to maximize returns.
So, right.
Like, yeah, that's really how they think. And that is, I guess, their legal obligation. But
yes, and it is convenient, you know, not that it's not true, but it is convenient for private equity firms to be able to say, look, it's not our money, it's just for the teachers, nurses, firefighters, etc. Of course, no one is winning out more than the private equity firms and their partners themselves. CalPERS and almost every other pension fund across the country is dramatically underfunded. So the idea that these guys are rolling in money because of private equity is not quite true. Even setting aside the idea that we have to screw over the Toys R Us workers in order for these guys to get their retirement.
And the evidence on the returns from private equity is mixed at best. Pension funds will say they need the returns to pay their retirees. And as you point out, you know, their sponsors often don't throw in enough money, so they're woefully underfunded. But if you look at risks and fees, you might end up doing just as well with an index fund.
Yeah, it's weird. The evidence on this is all over the map, and private equity firms will point to the studies that say they outperform, and activists against private equity will point to studies that say exactly the opposite. And it's one of those things where you kind of can make the numbers say whatever you want. So surely the truth is somewhere in the middle, where sometimes they outperform and sometimes they don't. But it is really interesting, because there are constantly these headlines about some pension funds or university endowments increasing their stake in private equity, and at the exact same time, others saying we're pulling out of private equity, using the exact same logic, they've come to different conclusions. So Yale has been very public about pulling a bunch of their endowment out of private
equity. They are one of the pioneers.
Yes, yes. And just recently, they decided to pull some of their money out of private equity because they're worried about the effect of Trump's war against universities financially, and they feel like they need more liquid money than you can possibly have in a private equity fund. That money is locked up for a long time. Yale's doing that. At the very same time, there are plenty of other organizations going harder into private equity right now. So it's really constantly kind of all over this place.
I'm speaking with Megan Greenwell, author of Bad Company, Private Equity, and the Death of the American Dream, just out from Day Street Books. Okay, back to some of your stories. Roger, the doctor, wanted to be a rural doctor and found his wish in Wyoming. Tell us his story.
Roger is in his mid-80s now, and he's just such a philosophical thinker about what it has meant to work in medicine. He really grew up idolizing his uncle, who was a community doctor in Texas. And Roger, when he came out of residency, he served at a fancy suburban hospital outside of Dallas for a while. And he was just miserable. He was like, I don't want to play bridge and play golf and smoke cigars with these guys. I want to be a small town community doctor. And so he moved his entire family to Riverton, Wyoming, a town of about 10,000 people. There was a community hospital there.
By the way, this kind of place is notoriously difficult to recruit doctors to come to. So it's unusual to find a guy who really wanted to go there.
Yes, exactly. Roger was and is a complete anomaly in terms of people who actually want to dedicate their lives to rural medicine, and had the firms that bought his hospital had any sense, they would have held on to him like gold, because that is very, very difficult to find. And instead, what happened is the private equity firm that came in consolidated his hospital called Riverton Memorial Hospital with another one about 30 miles away. And originally it was supposed to be, we're consolidating IT and billing and things like that just to free up some money for actual patient care. But pretty quickly they started cutting vital services at Riverton's hospital, and Roger really started to fight when the hospital lost its OB ward. So all of a sudden you couldn't deliver a baby there. You had to drive 30 miles away through this incredibly treacherous canyon. I have driven it in order to deliver a baby.
Delivering babies is pretty basic stuff for a hospital. I mean, I can understand not being able to do brain surgery in the middle of nowhere, but, you know, delivering a baby?
Yes, and one thing I really admire about Roger is how clear-eyed he is about what rural medicine should and should not do. He has always been very explicit that he is not looking for Riverton's hospital to do brain surgery. There are just so many things that you can't realistically provide in a rural setting. But right, we're talking about like taking out appendixes and delivering babies, like the really, really basic stuff that any rural hospital has always been able to do. But since private equity got involved, fewer and fewer of them can. And the statistics on the availability of maternity care in rural hospitals are really, really concerning. And a lot of that is because private equity has just gobbled up rural hospitals, in part, you know, like we talked about, to sell off the real estate and charge the hospitals rent, and in part to cut these basic services and introduce like very expensive, very high-tech services that nobody really needs. And so it really is the exact opposite of why Roger got into this field. He wanted to provide care on a very human level, and he ended up working for this firm where the humans had nothing to do with it.
We should say that the retail sector, private equity has pretty much completed its ravaging campaign in the retail sector, but healthcare is still for them a growth area.
Yes. So they are mostly out of retail. Walgreens just got purchased by a private equity firm, so there are exceptions. But for the most part, yes, they're out of retail. Healthcare is a much newer area of serious investment for private equity. And what's interesting is you see the private equity firms taking the lessons they learned from retail and applying those directly to hospitals. Like chronologically, you can see ideas like sale-leaseback agreements move from retail to healthcare as if they are providing the same services. And that's fundamentally the issue, is it doesn't matter whether you're delivering babies or selling toys. It's just another widget that is endlessly replaceable.
And if you have to pay off the enormous debt that is taken out to pay for these takeovers, you don't have much left over for Band-Aids and basic equipment.
Yes, exactly. So you see, that's where you see these services getting stripped. The prices for basic medical care go up and the quality of care goes down. There was a landmark study in 2023 that shows that the rate of preventable medical complications goes significantly up after a hospital is acquired by private equity. There is very little doubt that patients are losing out here. That's just not what matters to the people in charge.
Okay, now Lauren Tennant, who becomes an organizer, private equity has since, particularly since the 2008 financial crisis, really gotten deeply involved in buying up rental buildings, rental apartments, but also single-family houses. So, yeah, tell us the story of Lauren and how she represents what's been going on in real estate.
Lauren and her family moved to a huge apartment complex in Alexandria, Virginia, called Southern Towers. And they moved there directly from public housing. They had been evicted from a previous place after two layoffs. They were in public housing. They had a terrible experience there. And their version of the American dream was, we want to live in a safe place with enough room for our two kids where we're not worried about them walking around. And so they found Southern Towers, which has a 7-Eleven right downstairs and multiple swimming pools on the property. And they were able to afford a 3-bedroom apartment. And it really did seem like after several years in public housing, they had made it. They did not know that shortly before they had moved into the building, it had been bought by a private equity firm, and that private equity firm really sort of wanted to change the tenant base. Southern Towers, like I say, is absolutely huge, 2,300 apartments, and a lot of them are occupied by relatively recent African immigrants and refugees. That is not who private equity wanted in the building. They wanted to raise rents and increase amenities and get these people out. Now, Lauren is not an African immigrant, but her parents are. And so when everything started going wrong at the apartment complex, there was a flood that evicted Lauren and her family and 14 other families from their units for like 6-8 weeks. And she was the one who said, look, I have a lot more privilege than a lot of people in this complex. I'm going to stand up and fight for them. And she suffered absolutely devastating consequences just because her landlord wanted to target her specifically for being a troublemaker. The fact that she never backed down and she never said, okay, you know, I need this apartment is just, I think, a thing that not very many people would do. I'm just always sort of blown away by Lauren's drive when I talk to her.
Okay, and then finally, Natalia, reporter, and she really reflects what's been going on in newspapers. Newspapers have some really serious long-term problems, but it looks like private equity really accelerated those.
One defense that private equity always falls back on is, well, we didn't cause the problems in these industries, which is true. And nowhere is it truer than the newspaper industry. I graduated into a local newspaper job in 2006, 2007, when every newspaper in the country was just throwing all of its content online for free and then being absolutely shocked that their number of print subscriptions was declining. So there were really fundamental problems here. Natalia, who is in her mid-30s, was not a part of creating those problems. And what she saw was that private equity firms, while coming in and playing the swashbuckling heroes, being the ones who can solve the problems, instead were not even trying. I mean, there was no attempt at innovation, at different kinds of coverage, at anything that would do a better job of monetizing local journalism. The only strategy was cut and consolidate and cut and consolidate. And Natalia, who's a Mexican immigrant, she doesn't have a four-year college degree, but she made it into a journalism job because she just is very driven. And she ended up the chair of her union at the Indianapolis Star going against Gannett, which at the time was largely controlled by a couple of private equity firms through ownership, but also just through who owned the debt. It was like talking to a brick wall in her description. There was no actual negotiating with them because they couldn't see any solution to any problem that wasn't just cutting more salaries and more people. And so that was a super disillusioning experience for her to sort of say, wait a second, like, we're not negotiating with people who are also trying to make our newspaper better and might just have a different philosophy about how to do that. These are people who truly do not care what we do and are just going to get to the point of laying us all off.
They just wanted to bleed the thing for its assets. They didn't really care about it being an ongoing enterprise.
Right, exactly.
Okay, so finally, the people in your book did heroic jobs fighting these monsters, but we really can't get private equity under control without serious political action, could we?
I think it's going to require a multifaceted approach, but I think political action is necessarily a big part of it. I think without regulating the industry, they just continue to run unchecked. Regulation at the federal level is pretty unlikely without a dramatic change in the composition of Congress. Elizabeth Warren has proposed a bill to regulate private equity many times, but 88% of members of the House and Senate receive private equity donations. So sometimes people erroneously think that this is a Republican problem, but just as many Democrats receive private equity money, and in many campaign cycles, they receive more money than Republicans. So it's probably unlikely on the federal level anytime soon. There is some interesting stuff happening on the state level in many places. In Massachusetts, there was a great bill. In Oregon, they just passed a pretty landmark bill regulating private equity in healthcare. So there is some stuff happening.
That was Megan Greenwell, author of Bad Company, Private Equity and the Death of the American Dream, just out from Day Street Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more from the mad scene, this Water Tanks. Till next week, bye.
The biggest monuments, insurance companies, and banks.